relationship between sexuality and capitalism. And I'm going to focus on a discussion of Foucault and in comparison to Marx. And from there, I will try to interpret some of the historiography of sexuality worldwide, mostly on prostitution, masturbation, homosexuality in different parts of the world, pornography in different parts of the world, to try to understand how can we see that historiography in the context of the theoretical debate that I'm trying to carry on. So I think one of the most important things to understand about Foucault is his idea of sexuality as a fictional unit. Foucault thinks that sexuality doesn't exist outside of a modern society. I'm twisting Foucault a little bit here because Foucault is basically an anti-modernist. So, but he ends up, I think, in the end, saying that sexuality is fundamentally a modern concept that didn't exist before in other kinds of society. And it's a fictional unit. What does that mean? Well, most of the studies on sexuality, when they try to define sexuality, when they try to work on sexuality, actually, do not provide any kind of definition. And if we think about it, there's absolutely no definition of sexuality. If you look at it in the dictionary, for instance, sexuality will be something sexual, usually. And sexual will be something related to sexuality. That's in the Oxford Dictionary, in any dictionary you find. And, I mean, if you try to apply the idea that it's something on reproduction, obviously there are a lot of non-reproductive sexual acts. So what is that puts all those acts together? To say it bluntly, what's in common between licking a booth and a penis-vagina relationship? There's absolutely nothing in common between them. So there has to be something in social experience that actually puts them together and creates the idea that something like sexuality exists, that masturbation and a penis-vagina relationship and anal penetration and sadomasochism and all these different sexual acts are actually one unit. And Foucault says that that's a fictional unit. Now, what is that constitutes that unit? Foucault says that it's a kind of relationship between sexual act and subjectivity, in the sense that sexual acts in modern societies are not inconsequential. They always mean something about the definition of the subject. Foucault says this by claiming that sexual acts talk about sexuality is something about the truth of our being. So it's clearly related to our subjectivity. To put an example, masturbation, the relationship that each one of you has with masturbation is going to define who you are as subjects. If you masturbate too much, that means you are very liberated, or that means you don't have moral fiber. So it can be one sign or the other, but it's not inconsequential. It means something about who you are. And it can mean other things, not necessarily the two I mentioned. I mentioned like two extremes. One, the sexual liberation idea of masturbation will liberate asshole, or the more like right-wing idea of you lack moral fiber. But one or the other, anything in the middle, it always has an implication for who you are. It can be, when you eat chicken, it doesn't have that kind of implication. It's not that because you ate chicken, you have this kind of subjectivity, you are this kind of person. But when you actually carry on a sexual act, it's in social experience, both for yourself and for the people that know you, it has an implication. It might have different implications, but it always has an implication. Even the abstention from masturbation has an implication. It means you're too repressed, or it means you really have a moral fiber, whatever sign, moral sign again, it still means something strong about who you are. So Foucault says that actually what gives a unity to sexuality is the fact that all the sexual acts are have this kind of connection with subjectivity. So that's why we experience them as being one unit, as sexuality as being one thing, even if there are very disparate acts that we're talking about. Now, what I criticize about this guy, I think this is a brilliant insight by Foucault. But the problem with this is that Foucault never tries to explain why is that this happened. And I think that within Marx's point of view, we have really a very good framework to try to understand why is there that sexuality is a fictional unit where there's a number of sexual acts connected to subjectivity was formed. Why is that this fictional unit with this characteristics was formed? To try to understand that, I did this horrible graph on Marx, and I'll stop talking about sexuality for a little bit to try to go to a very brief, I mean, I think this is something none of us should do, like try to summarize Marx in 2 minutes, but when Marx talks about the commodity form, and he talks about the two sides of the commodity, the use value related to the particular kind of labor that's involved in producing that specific commodity as a use value, as a commodity that has a specific purpose. And on the other side, the other side of the commodity form is the issue of value, which comes from general comparison of the labor involved in producing those commodities. So what matters when we talk about value is not so much the particular kind of labor that's involved in the production of that commodity, but the general comparison between all kinds of labors. So in the trading and exchanging of commodities, we're comparing that, and we're creating, through social experience, the category of abstract labor, which is not something that exists in reality, but it has a materiality, a social materiality that's much more stronger than concrete labor. One of the fundamental aspects of abstract labor is that it is one of the most important social mediations in a capitalist society, because most of us relate to each other in not just personally, but in a worldwide web. We all relate to each other through the exchange of through the formation of this abstract labor. We do not live in self-subsistence economies where we produce what we need for ourselves. We live in a society where we have to buy the commodities that we need for survival, and in order to achieve those commodities, we have to sell our labor force. So what that means is that abstract labor is the major mediation between us. What that creates, according to Marx, is a contradiction between the character of social structure on one side and agency on the other, a contradiction between subject and object. Abstract labor emerges as an objective character, as something that we cannot control, and that's what constitutes the fetishism of the commodity, the fact that we cannot control the market transactions and the results of how abstract labor operates. So it is something that we experience as objective, and in opposition to that, we develop a subjectivity that is directly in contrast to that. So this contradiction between object and subject, which is referred to in social theory with many different terms, object can be structure, determination. I'm not sure I'm using the right English word here with determination. I mean the determining of the structure, right? And the contradiction with the subject or agency as opposed to structure, free will as opposed to determination. Now, how can we use this scope to try to understand how can we use this to understand Foucault's framework? Because Foucault's framework, in a way, is telling us that sexuality is something that's closely linked to subjectivity, that without this connection between the sexual act and subjectivity, we wouldn't have sexuality as a fictional unit. So how is that we can use Marx's point of view, which tries to provide an epistemological, social epistemological understanding of the formation of the difference between object and subject in modern societies, how is it we can use this to try to understand Foucault's point of view? And I think there's something that we have to consider here. Why is the relationship between sexual act, why does this relationship between sexual act and subjectivity happen, which is, I think, the question that Foucault is not asking. And I think that something that's crucial in this sense is that sexuality appears to ourselves. It's something that in the social experience we perceive as something that's more distant from objectivity, because there are many more mediations with abstract labor, between sexuality and abstract labor. So that makes us experience sexuality in a much more subjective way. To put it in terms of the early Marx, for instance, in the 1848 manuscripts, when Marx talks about alienation, he refers to having sex and eating as two things that humans in a capitalist society experience as the heart of their humanity, precisely because there are other aspects, fundamentally labor, where they can't experience that subjectivity, where they experience themselves as manipulated by objectivity. So sexuality, in a way, provides this kind of very mediated relationship with the commodity form that then makes it for a subjective interpretation of sexual acts. And I think this is crucial to understand why is that in modern societies there's this connection between sexual acts and subjectivity that Foucault is talking about. So I'd like to try to use this to understand some of the discussions on the global historiography of sexuality, basically on the issues that I've listed here: prostitution, masturbation, homosexuality, and pornography. So let's think about the issue of prostitution. The most important myth on prostitution is that it is perceived as the oldest profession on earth. What historians have found out, actually, is that it's one of the most modern professions. Modern prostitution has a characteristic that never existed before. Pre-modern equivalents, I don't think we can call them prostitution. Pre-modern equivalents are an exchange of resources for multiple service. So, to quote an example, we could refer to the model of the geisha, for instance. The model of the geisha is not a prostitute in the sense that the geisha, for instance, is hosting the man. So it's a kind of mixture of a hotel together with a philosopher and an artist and someone that's offering a number of services. And together with that comes sexuality. But sexuality is not distinguished as something that's separate from all that. In fact, there is no conceptualization of the sexual act as something distinct from all those other services that are provided. And that is exchanged for resources that powerful men have. So in pre-modern equivalents, what we have is some kind of powerful man that's able to have some kind of lover relationship with a woman through providing services and providing resources to that woman and getting all kinds of services that are mixed up, where sexuality does not appear as a distinct, discrete act, as a different thing. Modern prostitution has an absolutely different characteristic. Modern prostitution is an exchange of sex for money. So there's a very specific sexual act for which the prostitute gets money. And that's something that started happening basically with the coming of modernity. So let's see, for instance, how is that historians explained this for some global cities like Shanghai, Nairobi, Buenos Aires, Paris, London, St. Petersburg. There's a number of studies that have been conducted by historians in different parts of the world. And there's a common structure about the emergence of modern prostitution. In general, modern prostitution emerges first in with the formation of hubs that are connecting the hinterlands to the world market. So let me give you an example. Buenos Aires, from where I am from, Buenos Aires is the capital of Argentina, and what's happening is that it is becoming the major hub, a commercial center that's concentrating all the production of commodities that are coming from the hinterlands and connecting that with the world market. So it attracts a large migration of men. One of the things that happens late 19th century, early 20th century in some of these cities is that there's a huge proportion of men that are migrating and very little women, not many women. There's a male sexual demand for prostitutes, and in that context, the formation of modern prostitution, women engage in commercial sex with men. What this historical experience suggests is that the formation of modern prostitution as exchange of sex for money is related to the developing of the world market and the developing of hubs that are the fundamental connection within the world market. Only in that context you have the emergence of this exchange of sex for money. And what's interesting is this is happening at different times in different parts of the world. But it always happens at the time where that region is being integrated into the world market. So for instance, for St. Petersburg, this is already happening in the late 19th century, or for Buenos Aires. For Nairobi, this is happening in the 1920s. For Shanghai, this is happening in the late 19th century. For Paris, this is happening in the early 19th century. So it's different time periods, but those time periods share something in common, which is the integration of that area into the world market. So we can see how the formation of sex is a distinct act that's separate from all the other services that were provided before, emerges together with the coming of globalization. Masturbation. The history of masturbation is not developed for most areas of the world. The only place where there's serious research on this is Europe. But I think it does offer some interesting insights on the relationship between the coming of capitalist modernity and sexuality. One of the things that Thomas Lacour, in his work on masturbation, notices is that before the 18th century, there isn't a concept of masturbation. And what this means is that people do not identify masturbation as an act. That doesn't mean they didn't touch their genitals and have an orgasm or experience some kind of sexual pleasure. That might have happened in the past, but that's not masturbation. For us, masturbation is something else. It's a relationship to the self, and it's related to the formation of the modern self. Something that Lacour says that I find especially insightful is his analysis of Onania. Onania is a small pamphlet that was sold. It was written for the first time. It's an anonymous text in 1712. And it started to circulate in Great Britain, and it spread out quite quickly. But unlike Foucault proposed this work, Foucault sees this formation of subjectivity as something that's mostly related to medicalization, for the formation of the medical corporation. What Lacour says that's really interesting is that's not the way it happened. This text was made really not by an important professional physician or promoted by an important medical corporation. It was actually kind of a hoax. It was actually kind of a fake thing. I don't know if fake, but it's a pamphlet that comes together that says that if you masturbate, it will really make you sick, and the best thing is to buy this medicine together with that comes with a combo price that's really reasonable, so you should buy it. And it's a great commercial success. It starts spreading all over Great Britain, and people independently start to produce this book to get together with some water, with something that's sold as medicine to recover from your vices. And what's interesting is that it is some kind of grassroots spreading, but it's a spreading that's related to the formation of coffee shops all throughout Great Britain that are the major centers of commercialization in the different towns at the time. It has to do with the formation of the market, the strengthening of the capitalist market in Great Britain. So there had to be something that people were experiencing in order to be able to buy a book that was telling them that a sexual act was going to have some consequence for their subjectivity, in this case, sickness. Something had to sound reasonable about that, that had to be related to people's experience, social experience. It's not a knowledge power thing, as Foucault describes it, but it has to do with the rise of the modern subject. In a different, the rise of the modern subject in a different sense. The concept of homosexuality and the way that historians have explored it in different parts of the world is also, I think, interesting to understand the formation of sexuality and its connection to capitalism. Something that I find especially interesting is that a relatively similar concept of homosexuality emerges both in Europe and Japan, relatively independently and without intellectual cultural influence. So what do I mean by homosexuality here? Foucault claimed that homosexuality was different from sodomy in the sense that sodomy was just a sexual act that did not have consequences for the constitution of subjectivity. So anyone could carry on that act. That didn't mean that it was allowed for everyone to do that. It was considered a mortal sin, but it wasn't considered as a sin that only a group of the population would commit because they have a particular lifestyle or identity or something of that sort. The idea of a sexual act with a person of the same sex is something that constitutes yourself as a being, as a type of person, heterosexual opposed to homosexual. That's a pretty modern idea. This kind of opposition does not happen just in Europe. It pops up in different parts of the world. For instance, in Indonesia, it seems to be popping up in the early 20th century, although I think we need a lot more research for that. In Japan, it's popping up in the late 19th century. In Europe, it's beginning to pop up in the late 19th century. These different concepts that pop up in different parts of the world are, again, emerging in and they may be emerging at different chronological times, but it's usually the moment in which the area is being incorporated into the world market in a stronger way. So I think that what this different historiographies are suggesting is that there's a close connection between the spreading of the commodity form that appears as an objective thing that's outside our control, and the development of sexuality is something that's inherently ours, that constitutes our subjectivity in a stronger way. So I think the social history that some historians have been carrying on in their attempt to understand the formation of sexuality worldwide is something that actually gives us some empirical clues to try to go in the direction that I was trying to move when I discussed my interpretation of Foucault from a Marxist point of view. I hope I didn't go too fast or be too confusing, or so I open the discussion.
Thank you.
Presentation, which I know sounds pretty independent, but I did. And I can't always say that for the things I hear. The couple questions I have that I'm wondering whether you've looked into the difference between the history of representation and the history of, let's say, other kinds of production of effects. So to say that we first encounter something I mean, you mean in a historiographical way. It's not archaeological, obviously. Or is it? It might be archaeological.
I'm not following you, sir.
In other words, you didn't find underground whorehouses to decide that this is when sexuality became commercialized in 12th century Rouen or something.
No. What I mean is the records we have.
You found a text. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering whether it's the reproduction of the, you know, the representation of the act or the discussion of the act or the act itself that becomes identified as connected with these commercial functions as you have. That's one question I have. So is it the evidence or the activity of the evidence? And evidence of what? Of representation or the act? Or the experience of the act? All right? Or acts. There are different kinds of acts. That's one question. Another question, it seems to me, that comes up here is a question of class, because you said, well, sex just for money is modern. But you'll excuse me if I say a little bit about prostitution. And when you get more expensive prostitutes, they supply a lot more than just the sex acts. So even today, there's a lot, certainly sex is sort of the headline, but it's in terms of time or attention, it's not even the biggest part of the time or of attention. So those are a couple of points I just want to bring up. Call it escort services.
Should I hear more questions? And then
you can directly respond to however you choose.
Regarding the issue of the evidence, I think the kind of analysis that has focus on texts and on representations has been pretty damaging for historiography, in the sense that it has created a historiography where basically we only explore the views of the elite, because mostly they're the ones that have left texts, and that seems to believe that everything that happened is a kind of effect of something that was said in a text. In that sense, I think we need to correlate the text with, from the point of view of an analysis of social history, try to correlate the text with an analysis of the socioeconomic developments that are happening as a context for those texts. And then we can see things in a very different way. But for instance, when you see a text from ancient Greece, for instance, Eva Cantarella, an Italian scholar who works on ancient Greece, she says, for instance, you can find these cases in ancient Greece where there are temples that men get in and have sex with women, and when they leave, they put some money there. Now, the way these people understand this is they went to the temple, and they were part of a religious activity, and they get money to contribute for the temple. I mean, for a modern person, that may be understood as prostitution, but it's not prostitution at all. It's paying for religious activity. And the fact that we see it as prostitution today has more to do with our own prejudices and the fact that, oh, come on, they're just trying to hide it. The only thing he's interested in is sex. And maybe, I'm not saying here that there's no interest in having the sexual act particularly, but it's clearly the web of meaning where it's situated, it's very different from modern prostitution. So in general, when we try to consider exactly how is that people are interpreting it, I think we don't see this exchange of sex for money. And it's true that in the present there are things that go beyond, like escorts, that go beyond the exchange of sex for money. But there exists prostitution per se. The most important phenomenon is the commercial sex rather than the other one. And in any case, it's not general services for resources. There's clearly, first of all, money involved, and it's a very circumscribed commodity, that it's maybe it's sex, but it's sex together with an amount of time to go with you here or there. It's not the kind of relationship where the other person is kind of a lover or something like that. So it is a commodity. The commodity may not be only sex, but it's a commodity. In the other case, in the pre-modern case, it's not a commodity. And there isn't specific payment for a commodity. There's exchange of resources for services, which is different from the way in which the commodity form operates. But you want to say something? I thought you raised your hand. Sorry.
Go ahead, please.
I was just going to add something to what you said. I saw a film called The Girlfriend Experience, mm-hmm. and I don't know much beyond about modern prostitution beyond that, mm-hmm. But I think that film captures exactly what you said isn't there today, which is sort of a relationship beyond the sex or beyond the exchange, and it really is, I think, in that film, and maybe in society.
It's a historical film? A historical film?
No, it's a contemporary film about contemporary.
With a porn actress as a regular actress.
Yeah, but
how is it called? The Girlfriend?
The Girlfriend Experience. Named because that is the experience that's being paid for, mm-hmm. one having a lover or a girlfriend going beyond sex. I'm wondering, what do you think about that?
I think currently you have some forms of prostitution that have gone beyond the poor sex for money, and I would say that those are not exactly prostitution, but I still think it's a commodity exchange, which is not the case in pre-modern societies. And I think that what you see in the late 19th century, early 20s, and varying with depending on what area of the world you're talking about, with modern prostitution is like a more kind of pure, if you can say it like that, pure exchange of sex for money, and it happens. The reason why it's only sex usually, and it's usually, you know, it's interesting that it tends to be 15 minutes to half an hour in different parts of the world, and it emerges precisely because there's a huge disproportion of men that's related to this kind of social landscape that I was presenting. Very few women, and there's a demand for specific sex, and it has to be cheap, and that's why it's like 15 minutes to half an hour, and it's only sex. That's, I think, the classic example of modern prostitution. Today, we do have other forms, I think. I still think they're different from pre-modern cases in the sense that there might be more things than sex involved, but it's a commodity exchange in a way that it's not in pre-modern societies. But, yep.
I was asked to be a discussant for his presentation, so it's privy to Pablo's remarks in advance. And I wanted to thank Pablo for an extremely ambitious presentation. As he points out in his written remarks, the predominant literature and approach to sexuality, in particular on the left, has been what he calls external. In that most Marxists treat sexuality as one of the many things ruined by capitalism. So one of the things that abolishing capitalism will do is allowing the unfettered possibilities of sexuality to flourish. And he rightly points out that the most intelligent theorists on the problem of sexuality have realized the distinctly modern question of sexuality. And thus, Pablo has turned our attention to the relationship between sexuality and that of the creation of an industrial working class, as well as the development of the commodity form and possibilities for human agency and freedom. I think that these are some of the central questions that Pablo raises quite provocatively. To summarize his account, the establishment of capitalism erects a system of commodity production in which workers constitute the world around them through their labor, but in an alienated form. And what this means is that they're producing not their own lives and their own life's activities, but they're producing commodities, which are subject to the abstract whims prevailing over society as a whole, what Marx called abstract value or abstract labor time. And that this creates a structure of domination in which no one in particular is in control. This makes the domain of work alienating and experienced as something not us. As Marx points out, humans under capitalism come to recognize their own true identity only in the spheres outside of the workplace, in family life, in sexual life, in eating, in the base fulfillment of organic needs. And thus, we might productively view sexuality as being made possible by this this tension between an objective structure of commodity production, on the other hand, and the possibilities for freedom that are being engendered within it. But I wanted to push you on how you saw these two as being in tension with one another. A couple observations.
What is in tension, sir?
Specifically, the structure of subject and object, because I didn't get a clear perception of what exactly then is oppressive or dominating in this structure. If capitalism allows us spaces of freedom, in what way is that freedom itself constrained or shaped or otherwise cut off by capitalism? It seems as though many turn of century critics who focused on questions of sexuality or meaning in life, people like Freud or Durkheim, who pointed out the rising preponderance of suicide in modern life, Freud, the rising development of neuroses, which were pathological ways in which sexuality was expressing itself. Sexuality was present, Freud realized, but in ways that were undermining people's capacity for happiness. At the same time that they have the free time, they're using that free time to worry about themselves and causing themselves all kinds of suffering. And another observation that occurred to me is that for Marx, it's not entirely the case that he viewed the workers as subjects and the commodities as objects. It seems as though in the account in Capital, he views the commodities as the subjects and the workers as the objects, which Lukács then uses as the ground for his understanding of class consciousness. That class consciousness isn't simply the subjectivity that's kind of split off from commodity production, but rather commodity production itself becomes consciousness, consciousness as a mode of domination, as a kind of historical contradiction. But if we accept Lukács' view on this, then it seems as though that leaves sexuality uncomfortably hived off from the project of emancipation. So how do we reconcile the tensions within the commodity form and still help us understand what the tasks of a sexual emancipatory politics would look like today?
I think it's a problem to say that the commodity is the subject and the worker is the object, in the sense that I think it's a tension, a contradiction between the two that unfolds, rather than one specific thing being the object, the other the subject. It's true that in commodity fetishism, the commodity is experienced as the object, as the subject, sorry, and you experience yourself as the object. But that is precisely what pushes people to define themselves as subjects. So because I experience myself as an object, I need some realm of life where I can see myself as a subject. And one of those realms of life, and a very strong one, is sexuality. So I may be an object, I may experience myself as an object in relation to the commodity form, but then I'm free because I pursue this sexuality of myself freely, right? So that's what makes me a subject. So it's in a way, the fact that the worker is made into an object is an impulse to encourage the push for subjectivity. I don't know if I'm being clear here.
I see what you're getting at, but I think that there's still a problem, because the subjectivity is not in itself unconstrained. I mean, really, Foucault's whole point of departure is that subjectivity becomes, in fact, a mode of domination. That people think that they're free. Sure, they think that they're free to pursue whatever sexual acts or, you know, fashion whatever identities that they have for themselves. But the idea of power knowledge that Foucault develops is to undermine that. Mm-hmm. It's to say that, in fact, subjectivity is a very subtle form of self-domination.
Oh, yeah, but I think the way we can reformulate that in a Marxist way is to say that, actually, subjectivity is a form of domination in the sense that we're forced to experience subjectivity not as full subject, but precisely on sexuality. So sexuality itself, the formation of sexuality, is a fetishized sphere of life in the sense that it makes you experience that that's where you have agency, that that's where you can be a subject, when in reality, by experiencing that, you're renouncing to be a full subject in all other senses. And that's what creates the idea of the unity of a sexual sphere as a sphere of modern life. That's why I think that the project of merely trying to fight for sexual liberation, in a way, it's fighting for a fetishized form of full subjectivity, of agency. I still think that that doesn't mean that the other conclusion that sometimes the left makes out of this, which is that no politics should actually consider sexuality seriously because of that precisely, because sexual liberation is a fantasy. But what happens is that in a society precisely where the commodity form creates the condition for sexuality to be a major way of experiencing subjectivity, sexuality is going to become a major issue within politics. So that's why you have a strong sexual politics. And I think from the point of view of emancipatory politics, you need to actually have a participation and intervention there without falling into the sexual liberation idea that sexuality, free sexuality, is going to solve everything. Passive sexuality was something that pre-existed capitalism, and if you take the fetters of capitalism out, then it would flourish and make us all happy and free.
You had a comment earlier.
Well, in fact, I mean, Greg actually preempted a couple of my questions, and Pablo, your last set of comments also kind of started to address this issue of the relationship between what we might broadly term kind of identity politics or sexual, or what you describe as kind of sexual politics, and I was wondering if you could kind of tease out the relationship to that and the left, both historically. I mean, the specter that you've raised of Marx is presumably to use Marx not just as an analytic, but to conceptualize kind of the politics of the left. And what relationship, I mean, if you would offer a critique or some sense of the way in which either gay, lesbian rights movements that currently exist and their conception of emancipation and how that might in fact not be in accord with a leftist conception of emancipation, or to what degree they overlap. I mean, what kind of a connection between the left and politics do you see between this kind of, I mean, it's a very fascinating history that you've sketched out. And
very compelling, also.
And very compelling, indeed. But, you know, just to speak kind of to the politics of that as well, I mean, maybe you could also, I guess what I'm asking is maybe you could also chart for us something of the history of the left's relationship to this question of sexuality. I mean, there have been kind of strange inversions, for instance, thinking of capitalism as something that would ruin the family, and now is something that now comes to be seen as the upholder of all kinds of patriarchal norms, right? I mean, there's a reversal that's occurred even on the left's own position on these things, but I was wondering if you could speak to the question of sexuality more specifically.
Well, I think it's difficult to summarize. You're asking me like a huge question in a way. I will take a part of it, which is the gay movement today. I think something that's happening in the gay movement today is that it's moving on to being a movement claiming for basic bourgeois democratic rights, rather than claiming that sexual liberation will achieve some kind of utopian world. And I see that as positive, because I think that the late 1960s, early 1970s sexual liberation movement within the you know, that was a major part of the gay and lesbian liberation that, I mean, it wasn't distinguishable, sexual liberation movement and gay and lesbian. I think that the problem is that they viewed sexuality as what was going to be like the major avenue for emancipation, and that's like, again, falling into a fetishized view of subjectivity and not being able to capture how the relationship between subject and object operates within a capitalist society. I think that today the movement has moved way beyond that. It's less radical, which is a problem. So it doesn't have an interest in thinking about emancipation, which I think we should push for that. But it's claiming for democratic rights such as full equality, for instance, like in the case of marriage or things like that. And I think we should follow that road of supporting democratic rights, but at the same time trying to think that we need to think of emancipatory politics in relation to sexuality in a different way. And I think what we should aim for is the dissolution, the disappearance of sexuality. Precisely. I mean, if we have a society where there is no this contradiction between subject and object, the idea that these sexual acts that constitute sexuality have something in common will start to crumble, and then the idea that those sexual acts have implications for who you are will crumble too. I don't think that's something that it's like a subjective attitude that I can say, oh, I don't have to consider myself gay or straight because that is like, no, I think we do experience that because there's a social context that drives us to experience that, and it's real, it's not a fantasy. But the transformation of that context will make that connection between sexual act and subjectivity irrelevant. And what that means is basically, I think that for emancipatory politics, what we should aim at is the dissolution of sexuality rather than free sexuality. The dissolution of sexuality as a fetishized form of free subjectivity. The idea of a full subjectivity where things that we consider sexual today would be included, but would not be seen as sexual, because we wouldn't have this kind of implication that sexual acts have a consequence for our subjectivity.
I think part of the problem is too statically associating the sphere of sexuality simply with the peculiarities of modern life under capitalism. And this has taken the form in a very conservative socialist mode, both in the social democratic movements as well as in the communist parties under Stalin as an actual condemnation of sexuality per se, that sexuality is bad, therefore we should eliminate sexuality because the socialist society, sexuality doesn't exist, therefore people will live proper proletarian lives with proper proletarian families reproducing the proletarian people and so forth. So I certainly agree with you that sexuality is a kind of indicator of unfreedom, and that the abolition of capitalism would entail the abolition of the social forms peculiar, the damaged social forms peculiar to it. But nevertheless, in what ways do you see sexuality as self-contradictory, as pointing at once to the existence of unfreedom within capitalism, but also the possibility of freedom beyond it. Not as something that is simply a residue of the commodity form, but it's something that is historically novel and must, by socialists concerned with emancipation, be realized or fulfilled or actualized.
I think that sexuality, in a way, carries the very contradictions of capitalism, which is the potentials together with the obstacles all at once. Mm-hmm. In the sense that sexuality does offer, I mean, the idea that I say that sexuality, in a way, would dissolve under a different kind of society, and their socialist society, I think there would, in the long run, there wouldn't be sexuality, which is different from elimination. I think it's like dissolution in the sense that we wouldn't perceive the sexual acts as being part of sexuality, because for us they wouldn't have implications for the definition of our identity. So that's what I think would be dissolved. But the fact that that will happen, I think does not mean that sexuality per se under capitalism is only a negative thing. I think that the fact that it pushes for further subjectivity is a positive thing that we can use in our favor. The problem is when we do not recognize the fetishized character of that and how that comes together with the obstacles, which is the very characteristic of the contradiction of capitalism, the potential together with the difficulty to achieve that potential.
But how do you mediate that? Because it seems as though you run a very difficult line behind accepting that capitalism is opening up possibilities for sexuality, and then obsessing over of coming to obsess over one's own sexuality, of coming to be identified as gay, lesbian, bisexual, or whatever, and becoming tied to your sexuality, emotionally attached, as it were, and therefore constrict in the process your own subjectivity by expressing it neurotically.
Well, I just think some people have to talk.
I just have a quick question about the relationship between subjectivity and the emergence of like a private bourgeois sphere. Mm-hmm. And it seems like a more recent development that has defined our lifetimes is the sort of the further reification of individual private acts into public identity categories. I don't really know how much further I can go with that.
Yeah, well, I think something we can say historically, and this also relates to something of what you were saying about Freud, and so I think something we can observe is in the first transition to an urban industrial society, what happens usually is that there's a strong persecution of all the forms of sexuality that are considered abnormal, and I think that part of the reason for that has to do with how sexuality is conceptualized at the beginning as an opposition between normality and abnormality. And the reason I think that's happening is that there is no explanation of why all these things are together outside of a constructivist point of view. And then the explanation that scientists find, and I think that the state buys into that, is the idea that, okay, there's the reproduction, which is the real one, and all the other ones are deviations. So what that creates is a political context where the deviations are going to be persecuted. Now, once sexuality is consolidated as a social sphere to the extent that we do not need to look for a definition, to look for an explanation, then the distinction between normal and abnormal starts to collapse. And it starts to collapse because the commodity form also tends to create the idea that all subjects are equal to each other, in a way. So the idea of equality under the law has material foundations. It's not just an ideal. So I think it tends to dissolve this difference between normality and abnormality, and it tends to constitute a sphere of sexuality where we see it more from the point of view of diversity, like different kinds of... but what that means, in a way... The first step into the formation of sexuality politically was a lot more oppressive, but it did show something that was interesting, which is they were aware, because they were in a moment of transition, late 19th century, let's say, they were aware of the need to give a definition of sexuality. And the definition was this normal and abnormal. This is the rule, and these are the deviations, and that's why we classify all this together. The fact that today... the normal-abnormal distinction has collapsed. In a way, politically, it's much more positive because it has given democratic rights to many people. But it also points out to a very problematic development, which is the naturalization of sexuality as something that exists per se, and we don't even need to provide a definition because there it is, and all these things are together, and they are sexuality. Don't ask what it is. We all know. So it creates a farther naturalization of sexuality in a way. And I think that's the context in which the sexual liberation movement emerges.
So. Final question.
I just had a question of sources, right? I mean, you give great sources to sort of outline the theme, right? But I mean, probably if we were in a room of full historians that study the 17th century and 16th century, you know, they would say, well, you know, there are forms. That are very similar to sort of post-industrialized, forms of prostitution, etc., that wouldn't seem anachronistic, to define them as prostitution in this sort of post-industrialized society. And there's a sort of more continuity, etc. So I was just wondering how you would
one thing I want to say is I think that the in historical terms, with the issue of prostitution, the kind of the way I presented it, it's the I think it's historiographical as the hegemonic way today. There's a very interesting article by Timothy Guilfoyle called "Prostitutes in History: From Parables of Pornography to Metaphors of Modernity." He's not a Marxist. He has not.
What's his name?
Guilfoyle. It's G-I-L. Foyle, and actually he teaches at Loyola, and it's called the American Historical Review. But yeah, you can forward this to everyone that I mean.
Sure, if you want, or you can just take down people's email addresses and.
Okay, yeah, you can
contact.
Send me an email. I can send you the bibliography and this, but he is this transition from pre-modern to modern. It's not something I say. It's something he says, and he's a specialist on prostitution, and he's summarizing basically around 50 to 60 works of historiography on prostitution, and he comes to the conclusion that this opposition between pre-modern and modern prostitution is basically what we can see in the historiography of dozens of historians that have worked on this. I found it very interesting that it matches with the kind of theoretical analysis that I want to carry on, but it's not my interpretation at all. So it is, in a way, within the maybe people that don't work on prostitution, they work on other things, may have a different point of view, but within the historiography of prostitution worldwide, it is probably the most authoritative point of view. I mean, this is an article from 1999. I've never seen an article that actually criticized this, and it's considered, it's quoted everywhere as like one of the kind of agreements that the field has achieved. So that I think you could discuss that, but I haven't actually seen criticism of this kind of interpretation so far. So,
well, unfortunately, we're out of time. However, we're breaking for lunch. So please join me in a round of applause for the public. It is lunch now, right? Okay, great. Grab some food. Register if you haven't already to actually get some food. And we'll see you back at the panels later this afternoon. I'm sorry.
I'm in the same nervous, but I am. And I didn't realize that I skipped your thing. I didn't know how to.
Oh, I just interpreted it. I just thought you didn't want to answer it.
No. I'm sorry, no, but I first. I,
oh, how's it going?
Okay, how are you?
Sorry to make first. I mean, I had all of them.
Oh, you're not.
Yeah,
that's fine. That was good.
I didn't realize.
Oh, it's fine. No.
I was nervous and I.
I was
wasn't managing the situation well, so I'm sorry.
I liked your presentation.
Yeah, me too. Very good. Very good. I wanted a couple points that really popped up for me. I liked your pun about erected. You know, you said he had erected some kind of metaphor. I don't know.
Oh, did I?
Yeah.
Well, that's a completely unconscious.
I know.
Feel free to check out people's email addresses.
So, here was two things I think maybe you'd find interesting. One is this makes me think about the whole question of subjectivity. Because if sex is such a constituent of modern subjectivity, then maybe you start thinking about how subjectivity is a function of the opposition to objectivity, which is a pretty limited sphere of selfhood. And I'm thinking about it, you know, something like that. Maybe subjectivity is itself a function of alienation.